general discussion period. So that's sort of Grameen to social business. Now we're going to look at sustainable business, and as I said at the outset this morning, looking at new ways of defining and describing capitalism. Stuart Hart is a professor of management at Cornell University and also the author of Capitalism at the Crossroad. And Kevin McGovern is the founder of the Water Initiative in the United States. So I guess we'll begin with Stuart, if you want to come up and talk about sustainable business.
Wonderful. Peter, thank you. Good morning to everybody. How are y'all doing this morning? 8 o'clock class, huh? It feels familiar. Certain familiarity there. Well, needless to say, this is an enormously exciting time in human history. I mean, I think that's probably, if there's one thing that unites all of us up here, it's the sense that there's something fundamental going on, right? That we really do. I hate to just shamelessly self-promote my book, but I will anyway, right? Capitalism really is at a crossroads. You know, so when this first came out in 2005, I think, you know, people, their first reaction was, well, isn't that a little over the top? I mean, what do you mean? But no one's saying that anymore. I mean, I think there's little doubt that we stand at an important threshold, that something fundamental is going on, that 20 years from now we'll look back and say this was the time when things really shifted. Similar, I think, to what happened, you know, back in the late 19th century when capitalism was invented in its current form. You know, in the space of 20 or 30 years, you know, I think we're undergoing a similar sort of tectonic shift, and it's really exciting. I think it's absolutely exciting. So there's a lot of experimentation, as there should be, right? There's no one way to skin the cat, and that's probably not a great metaphor for what we're talking about here, but there's no one way to do it, so I think it's very healthy that there are many, many different cuts at this. So what I'd like to talk about today is a version of moving to a sustainable form of enterprise that incorporates the profit motive. In other words, it may be that in some circumstances profit need not be a bad thing. Right? In fact, it might be jet fuel. It really might help turbocharge what we're trying to do. So let me talk about that a little bit. And this is around the idea of creating a form of commerce, a form of enterprise, that incorporates everyone. In that sense, I think we have a common vision. Not just the rich people, but everyone. A more inclusive form of enterprise. But a more inclusive form of enterprise that sustains and regenerates the planet at the same time. That's a tall order when you think about it. But I think that's the transformation process that we're undergoing. And it wasn't, you know, so I put up, you know, this idea of the world pyramid here. If you think about the world, you know, there are maybe a billion people like us, rich people, at the top of the pyramid, and they're everywhere throughout the world. It doesn't matter what country you're in. There's an emerging middle class. You know, I guess this Tom Friedman's notion of the flat world. I guess over the past year and a half or so, the flat world has been flattened a bit, right, because of the world economic crisis. And then, of course, there's the base or the bottom of the pyramid where fully 4 billion plus people live on less than $3 or $4 a day who have been systemically cut off, isolated, just and really disempowered, not included. And certainly that's the case when it comes to the large corporation and most startup companies as well in the developed world. It's just been off their radar screen. Oh, for 10, 20 years, companies have focused on moving incrementally down into the middle of the pyramid. You know, we would call that emerging market strategy. But the base of the pyramid has been largely ignored. So starting maybe 10 years ago or so, my colleague C.K. Prahalad and I put together a piece called The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. By the way, that was not our title. It's interesting to tell that story. The first version of the paper we wrote 10 years ago, so it's been 10 years, you know, basically 1998, 99. And the first title we had for the paper was Raising the Bottom of the Pyramid, Creating Sustainable Development. It went through about 8 or 10 iterations and ultimately was published as The Fortune of the Bottom of the Pyramid. That was the editor's title, not ours. But I've kind of rationalized it in my own mind, you know, as making sense because you can think of it has kind of double meaning because, you know, fortune can be a foretelling as well of what's to come. But I think what that did was make the case that there is an enormous potential market out there. And that's important. So I think we accomplished that goal. But I think more importantly, this idea of focusing on the base of the pyramid can be a real innovation driver. Because we see, you know, if you look at Grameen, what really comes through? Radical strategy and business model innovation, that there's no way you're going to be able to incorporate those who have been systematically cut out just with tweaking what you're already doing a little bit. You know, you're talking about radical business model and technology innovation, and I'll argue this is the place where we'll incubate tomorrow's green and clean technologies first. And then I also firmly believe that, you know, part of this transformation process, that the real innovation, tomorrow's successful 21st corporation, is being incubated at the base of the pyramid right now. There's a competitive preemption aspect to this. So big companies, American companies, European companies, Japanese companies that ignore this do so at their peril, because they will become extinct, you know, in the course of the next decade or so. So if you think about it then, this notion of the base of the pyramid now, I think, has been established as an opportunity in whatever way you choose to frame it. And it's really what, you know, what our colleagues at Grameen have been saying, that if you look at those at the base of the income pyramid, the traditional way of focusing on it by business people is to say, well, there's no money there, right? I mean, what are you talking about, $1,500 a year GDP, purchasing power parity or less? You know, I mean, that we can't do business there. But we all know that that's that part above, you know, the iceberg part above the waterline is just literally the tip of the iceberg. That the informal economy in the developing world is immense and constitutes the majority of economic activity in most countries. And that, as our friend Hernando de Soto has pointed out, people familiar with Hernando's work? Right. Not the conqueror, but rather the Peruvian economist. Has shown us that there are all kinds of what he calls dead assets, because the poor typically are squatters. They don't own their own home or their business. They don't hold title deeds. That there are all kinds of dead assets that if they were owned, could create tremendous capital potential. So there is enormous oomph, right? A potential lift there if you look below the surface. Entrepreneurial potential is huge. And in a sense, that's really what Grameen has been able to marshal, you know, the fact that there is this tremendous energy and commercial potential there. And it's a matter of unleashing it. And furthermore, I think what becomes clear, and somewhat counterintuitively, and this is from a piece by C.K. and Al Hammond, who used to be at the World Resources Institute, what becomes clear is that the poor typically get screwed, right? We all know that. Instinctively, we know that. The poor get the worst stuff at the highest cost, something called the poverty penalty. So if you just look here at a kind of a market basket of goods and services, comparing, you know, what the poor pay in Dharavi, you know, which is the largest slum in Mumbai, versus a very wealthy area in Mumbai, you can see that the poor pay a lot more. Right? Usually for the worst stuff, the oldest stuff, the least fresh produce, you know, the water that they buy is expensive and sometimes contaminated. And I'm kind of the setup guy for Kevin McGovern, who will come next and talk to you about the Water Initiative, which is a business specifically focused on trying to address this. But I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that there is a poverty penalty, right? That typically poor people pay the most, get the least, which means from a business person's point of view, you don't really have to be that good to create huge consumer surplus. It's like holding an umbrella over the top of this space, right? So there's enormous opportunity there. And so a lot of this then, over the last 10 years, I think these ideas now have become accepted, have become reasonably well established, even in most large companies. But I would say the initial assumption was, okay, you know, there are all these people, right, all these unmet needs, as we've been saying, nutrition, water, energy, health, so forth. Well, all we need to do was just go tap into that market, right? I mean, that was sort of the initial sense that came out of this line of work about the bottom of the pyramid. But I think what we've seen is that isn't so easy, right? It isn't necessarily the case that all these experiments now have come forward. We heard a bit from Professor Kander last night about P&G, you know, with the Pure and so forth. There have been, and this is just a short list, I could put up, you know, dozens of pages of corporate initiatives at the base of the pyramid. But I think it's fair to say that so far, right, and it's exciting. Again, experimentation is the watchword here. Over the past 6 or 8 years, you know, the period of time when most of this has happened, there have been very, very few success stories to be told. But I suppose that's to be expected at some level. If you look at some of them, you know, like Nike's World Shoe, right, an attempt to create an athletic footwear product for the poor in Asia. You know, Coke and P&G in the fortified beverage, and then P&G's Pure, you heard about that last night. Hindustan Lever, both in terms of their wheel, you know, their low-end detergent business, and then more recently their Shakti Entrepreneur Program, which is a micro-entrepreneur-based approach with village women distributing P&G or Hindustan Lever products. As exciting as all these are, you know, and they employ new business models and there's a lot of experimentation going on, they've mostly not been very successful. Right? I mean, if you're really honest, they've mostly not been very successful. You know, they've, in the case of World Shoe, it just crashed and burned. I mean, they never got a business model straight, you know. If you look at Pure, you know, essentially it moved from being a business experiment, or it moved over to the philanthropic side of the company. They gave up on it, you know, as a business opportunity. Shakti, you know, the Hindustan Lever stuff, it's created some short-term revenue, certainly Wheel did, but then it kind of ran out of gas, and the Shakti Entrepreneur Program, in truth, has been very push, you know, very resource-intensive to get tens of thousands of women entrepreneurs out in the villages, still hasn't broken even, and there's a lot of pushback coming from the villages. You know, in other words, high turnover among the Shakti entrepreneurs, fairly high levels of dissatisfaction, growing pushback coming from the countryside. So the way I think about that, you know, if I'm completely honest, is, you know, I think these are all important experiments, but they're really first-generation experiments. Most of these initial forays into the base of the pyramid have been what I call structural in character, meaning that, I mean, there is significant innovation just in that by itself, you know, where you have to bring unit costs down dramatically through things like sachet packaging and single-serve packaging, reduce production cost, outsourcing to local partners, extended distribution, you know, kind of mom-and-pop distribution or micro-entrepreneur distribution, partnering with NGOs on the ground. All of that is significant innovation. There can be no doubt about it, but it's mostly structural, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. The result has been sort of the child with a hammer, you know, that most companies just end up taking what they're already doing and putting it in small packages, and then they try to get it out there to sell it to lower-income people. I think of that as BOP 1.0, and like any innovation or any initiative, it both solves problems and it creates new ones. So I see two significant new problems or challenges that have emerged. Totally expected. Why would we expect anything different, right? I mean, we should respect the companies that have taken these initiatives because we've learned a hell of a lot in the last 6 or 8 years. You learn a lot from failure. I think that's the key message here. But I think one of the challenges that comes through is this kind of emerging notion of the misfortune at the bottom of the pyramid. Our colleague Anil Karnani at the University of Michigan has probably captured this the best. He published a piece, you know, with that title. And I think the spirit of it is that, you know, just sort of putting stuff in sachet packages and then marketing it to the poor isn't the answer, right? Does that really generate livelihoods? Does that really improve lives? Does that really solve problems? Or does it just make things worse in the long run? Are we just extracting what little money people have, you know, in their pockets to sell them, you know, whitening cream? That's his favorite one to pound on. Is this just the latest form of corporate imperialism, you know, this idea of selling to the poor? We have to take that very seriously, and I think what's emerging is an idea of embedded innovation, of co-creation, of getting a better sense of what is the real sustainable development impact out there, and that's what I want to focus on today. But then I think there's also a second challenge, which is becoming increasingly clear, that if all we do is take what we're already doing and put it in smaller packages for distribution, it's going to take us over the cliff environmentally, right? I mean, it just can't happen. So this problem of environmental meltdown becomes clear. Waste, you know, we 6.7 billion Americans, forget about it, right? I mean, it's the end of story. So there's an emerging set of work around the idea of Green Leap, that we can really incubate tomorrow's leapfrog point of view, small-scale green technologies first in the base of the pyramid and then trickle them up. And I think one of our panelists will talk more about that idea today. That there's a growing convergence, another convergence, right, between clean technology, green technology, and base of the pyramid. because of its disruptive quality, it's most likely to incubate first in the underserved or unserved spaces at the base of the pyramid and then trickle up. I'm not going to talk about that so much today, although that's a real strong focus for me. I want to talk instead about this idea of embedded innovation and then hand it off to Kevin. So if we think about this version 1.0 of the BOP, it's oversimplification, but I think it goes something like this, that the conception, the mental model is that, well, we can structure businesses where poor people are either the producer or the consumer, right? And that the stereotypical view is that, well, this whole BOP businesses idea is just treating the poor as consumers. So if all you do is treat them as consumers, that's not really going to create the sort of developmental impact that we want. We really need to think about the poor as producers, as though this is an either-or. Of course, it's not. Right? We need to listen and tailor the product for the poor, get the price point down, extend distribution, and then, of course, we'll work with NGOs because we don't know what we're doing, right? We need to work with NGOs in order to get down on the ground. That's sort of the structural innovation idea that I just talked about. It's created the new problems that I've just described. I think what we're coming to is a 2.0, where we, instead of thinking, well, we need, is this going to be a business where we're marketing to the poor, or are we going to, is this an inclusive supply chain where we're sourcing from the poor, that'll generate income? We need to get back past that, because this is not an either-or world. Instead, think of the poor as partners, right? As business partners, as our colleagues, not just suppliers or even consumers or customers, but rather as partners. And we need to enter into a two-way discussion, a dialogue, because there's important knowledge, skills, and capabilities embedded in poor communities that are dying to get out. Right? How do we incorporate that into a business concept? That can expand imaginations, that a company or a business, an established or startup, comes with certain capabilities, knowledge, technology, business skills, scaling skills, and so forth, that those in poor communities don't have. As wonderful as microcredit is, typically what you get is more of what poor people already know how to do. Not that that's a bad thing. I think it's a wonderful thing. But is it possible to think about intentionally creating a collision between these two worlds where you can incorporate knowledge from both sides and generate something, marry those capabilities together and generate something that neither could have on their own? So that's this idea of developing direct personal relationships. You can't outsource it just to NGOs. People in the company actually have to get on the ground, develop a relationship, build trust, because that's really what the name of the game is. So I think of that as embedded innovation, and I think that's what we're coming around to with this whole BOP territory. It's a mutual value proposition. Everyone needs to win in this model, including the company and the investors, right? In other words, there's no reason that money can't be made. We can shatter the trade-off here. We can, if we really do, it takes tremendous effort and creativity, but we can generate better outcomes for all the stakeholders, including the investors. So I think the BOP presents not so much just a marketing problem. You know, this whole idea of we need the sachet mindset in order to market this thing, you know, to the poor. It is, you know, clearly there are marketing challenges. Not so much just a technology problem where, you know, if we just get, you know, the killer app, if we can, you know, get the perfect solar technology or the LifeStraw or this, clearly there are technological challenges, but it's not just a matter of getting a gadget, right? We have lots of gadgets. It's really a business process challenge, first and foremost. That's really what this is about. So this idea of native capability or becoming embedded has everything to do with learning as a capitalist, right, as a business person, to engage with marginalized groups in a mutual business partnership. And I think that's Grameen shows that clearly, you know, how important that is. Professor Yunus just instinctively knew that that's what you had to do if this was ever going to work. To build long-term relationships of trust, and importantly here, to creatively marry company technologies with capabilities in poor communities through a process of co-creation. Kind of an overused term, but I'm going to try to be specific about what I mean by the idea of co-creation. And then evolve the business from the ground up. In other words, you can't start with a global business. You have to actually land it somewhere in an actual community, engage in this process on the ground, and then organically spread it. Scale it out from where it started, and then you can also begin to think about a transplantation process of taking the core DNA from that business and transplanting it elsewhere, exactly what's happening now with Grameen America. So over the past six, 7 years, we've developed a process for trying to do this called the Base of the Pyramid Protocol. And this started, as I say, you know, around 2003, right in there, when it was already becoming clear that we really needed to come to grips with these challenges. You know, companies like Hewlett-Packard and DuPont and SC Johnson and Tetra Pak were early supporters of this. They knew that if all we did was just use existing new product development techniques, you know, doing marketing research and focus groups, and that as far as the base of the pyramid goes, that this was going to be a big problem. It just doesn't work. So we engaged a broad variety of stakeholders from the international development world, from the environmental world, from the NGO world, applied anthropologists, you know, and then people from companies as well. Grameen was involved in this, in the development of the Base of the Pyramid Protocol. We did it through sort of a workshopping process, incorporating. We also didn't want to reinvent the wheel, so we brought in pre-existing methods like participatory rural appraisal, quick ethnography, empathy-based design, asset-based community development, and a variety of other things that are participatory around either community empowerment or economic development, and incorporated these into the protocol process. But the focus of the BOP protocol is entrepreneurship, that what we're interested in doing is starting a new business. That's what makes it different from perhaps some of the other pre-existing approaches. And you see some of the people that have been directly involved in it and some of the institutions. If you're interested in more information about the protocol, you see the website here. We actually developed a first cut at this out of these workshops, and now we've applied it in several different settings, starting the pilot test was with SC Johnson in East Africa, in Kenya. That's produced a new business called Community Cleaning Services in the slums around Nairobi. And then the first full application was with DuPont in India with their Soleil business, which is their soy protein business. And that's produced a new business, both a slum business as well as a rural business. And now the two newer And one of the applications you're going to hear about today, we started our first U.S.-based application of the protocol with Ascension Health in the U.S., focused on co-creating a better approach to getting health outcomes among the uninsured, and that project is happening in Flint, Michigan, you know, which has now about 30% unemployment and half the people have no health insurance in Flint. It's really something. And then the Water Initiative, which, you know, started about 2.5-3 years ago. And that's what Kevin's going to talk about in a moment, using this kind of approach as the way that we tried to generate the business concept. The whole idea is to get on the ground, build trust, homestays, not trying to sell anything to start with, so there's a method to this, right, of actually getting on the ground and building trust, and then through gradually a workshopping approach of resource sharing, you know, what does the company bring, what does the community bring, you eventually co-create a business concept. And the business concept is going to be more than just a product, right? It's more than just we got this thing, we want to sell it. Rather, it's a bigger community-based business concept, and there may well, there has to be, some kind of product embedded in it. But the whole idea is to co-generate a business that's attractive, that where the people in the community have helped to create it, so it pulls it in, right? Rather than just trying to come in and do social marketing and education programs to sell them this thing. You know, I think that's really where the P&G Pure thing fell flat, right? That they designed this wonderful sachet packaged thing, you know, in the lab, and the R&D people, and it's great, right? I mean, it's really sophisticated. It does do the job. But the problem is then you come into a community and you have this huge, you know, cultural divide. There's no behavioral tracking on this at all, and you're in this major, you know, social marketing and education program, you know, where you're spending literally hundreds of millions of dollars trying to change people's behavior. That's pretty tough. So the idea behind the protocol is to create a business that becomes pulled into the community, right? That it takes off like wildfire and spreads by word of mouth because people in the community have helped to create it. Right? That's the whole idea. So just to sum up, and then I'll step back. I have 1 minute. I really think, and that's what Kevin's going to talk about the water initiative in just a moment, but now let me just step back to finish up. I really think we're, as I said at the outset, we're at a kind of a choke point in human history, that what happens over the next 10 years or so is going to tell the story. And we've spent the last 50 years, you know, kind of laboring under this model of, quote, sustainable. We didn't call it that the whole time, but it's sort of the development model, the development era. And if we think of the two meta problems in the world, right, kind of big footprint, environmental footprint among the rich at the top of the pyramid, and then poverty and inequity at the bottom of the pyramid, these are, I'm always hesitant to use a military metaphor, but especially as an American, but I will, you know, in this case. You know, these are well-defended hills, right, to use a military metaphor. They've been around a long time. You know, the big footprint at the top has a, you know, there are incumbents that have positions to protect. They've got a lot of assets in the ground. A lot of them are fully depreciated, so they're making a lot of money. They're really resistant to seeing this thing shift very quickly, right? So there's a lot of inertia when it comes to the footprint. Look what's going on with the climate, you know, discussions, and look what's happening in the U.S. The same story at the bottom of the pyramid with poverty, right? I mean, there are a few people that do very well by keeping a lot of people poor. And the more that you can keep information asymmetry, keep people isolated, the more the, you know, graft you can take for yourself. I mean, this is a long-standing problem. And our approach, typically, for the last 40, 50 years has been, again, continuing the military metaphor, frontal assault. All right, when it comes to the big footprint, we're going to reduce consumption, you know, pollute. We're going to do that with regulation, try to guilt trip these big Americans to get them out of their Hummers, you know, and you know, create some incentives. And as important as it's been, it just hasn't worked that well. And I'd say similarly at the bottom of the pyramid, our approach is, well, we need to raise the standard of living. You know, we're going to do that through infrastructure development, industrialization, aid, and so forth. And while there have been some important victories, by and large, it just hasn't worked that well. So I think what we're talking about here, if we think about this notion of the protocol or reinventing capitalism or the Green Leap idea, still the same two problems, but there's a different way of looking at it. That, and it really is more of a judo move rather than frontal assault. We're going to use the opponent's weight to throw them. So rather than trying to, even though the big environmental, the biggest polluters and resource users and carbon emitters are us rich people, because of the resistance to it, it's not going to happen here first. So let's think about incubating tomorrow's technology not here first, but rather in the underserved, unserved spaces. That's kind of the leap to the base of the pyramid. That's going to require innovation writ large. We're going to need new business models, new partnerships, new business processes, as I've been saying. And if we do this, you know, dozens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of experiments and iterations of doing this. Some of them are going to work, some of them aren't. But we're going to generate income, we're going to raise standard of living, and oh, by the way, now we're starting to get after the poverty problem. And if that happens well, that's, you know, to invoke Joseph Schumpeter, right? This is really not creative destruction yet. This is pure creative creation. This is all new market creation. Right? And it's inventing tomorrow's industries. It's inventing tomorrow's more sustainable way of living, whether it has to do with healthcare, whether it has to do with water, whether it has to do with renewable energy, whether it has to do with biomaterials or biofuels or sustainable construction, what have you. Eventually, that's going to become so good, it's going to migrate up market. You can always add cost and features onto a low-cost platform and migrate it up market. Huge growth potential there, you know, from a capitalist point of view. Right? And then and only then, when it becomes so good, so affordable, so proven, it's going to trickle up and to the top of the pyramid, it's going to start to take out these incumbents that are protecting their position because they just can't protect it anymore against this. You know, there may be a lot of perverse incentives, but we can actually blow those out of the water. That's when the disruption occurs. That's when we see the reduction in consumption happen. That's when creative destruction occurs. I really think this is the dynamic that we're coming into. This is an important piece of this idea of new capitalism that we're talking about. Let me stop there because I'm already over time and turn it over to Kevin because Kevin is going to tell you a bit about an actual business experiment, a new venture, trying to bring some of this stuff into reality. So, Kevin. Thanks.